Anyone out there is able to do recording, please go ahead. Don't hesitate. Is the volume loud enough? Can I get a volume check? Too quiet, too loud? We can adjust. Google volume, okay. Good volume, great. Good stuff, okay. And yes, if anyone out there can record, please go ahead. But I am recording now, so hopefully it will continue. Alright, so today we're looking at the Chulahati Padopama Sutta, which was suggested by one of the group members. A reason I chose it out of the suggestions is because it is a pretty staple discourse. It's one of the many discourses that talks about the whole of the Buddha's path. So it goes through from beginning to end. I haven't gone over it yet for the study group, so because I just haven't had the time. But I do know the basics of the sutta, so hopefully I'll be able to wing it tonight. And hopefully the audience will be able to help, and we'll have some lively discussion. So let's just get started then, and we'll let people come in as they arrive. The first thing we do is do our preliminary homage, paying respect to the Buddha, to his teachings, and to the Sangha who have practiced his teaching. Sound is fine, no? This is a traditional thing to do during or before a study course. So we can say it together, you can say it in English if you like, or in Pali, or as you like. Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadin Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namang Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Okay. I don't know if everyone's having problem with the sound. It seems to be going fine at this end. So please do let me know if the sound is unlistenable, if you can't understand what I'm saying. Okay. This sutta has the staple beginning. So it's one of the suttas, one of the many suttas that the Buddha taught when he was at Savatthi in Jetavana, Anathapindika's park. So, you know, we're fast-forwarding way ahead, really. Where we left off in the last sutta, the Buddha had just taught 1,000 monks. And they had all, these were the fire worshippers, the three brothers and all of their followers. Then he went on to Rajagaha, took them with him, and Bimbisara came to see him and saw that there were all these, saw that these three great teachers, well-respected teachers, were now with the Buddha. And so all the people that were with Bimbisara, they asked themselves, Is it that the Samana Gautama is the student of Kassapa? Uruvela Kassapa? Or is it that Uruvela Kassapa is the student of the Samana Gautama? And so the Buddha looked at Uruvela Kassapa and asked him, So Kassapa, what's the case? Am I the student and you're the teacher, or are you the student and I'm the teacher? At this point they were all arahants, I believe. Yes, he was an arahant. And so he bowed down at the Buddha's feet and put his head to the Buddha's feet and said, I am the student, the Blessed One is my teacher. And that was really the start of the Buddha's fame and the Buddha's ministry, because at that point he taught King Bimbisara, who was the king of Rajagaha, and King Bimbisara became a Sotapanna. And many of his followers also gained an understanding of the teachings and the truth. And so Rajagaha became very much a Buddhist city. And then the story goes on and on, and I won't go into the story. We'll get it to it eventually in the Dhammapada. Eventually we'll get to the story of Visakha, because we have to talk about no story of the Buddha's history is complete without the story of Visakha, who was the Buddha's chief female lay disciple. And then we'll have the story of Anathapindika. Actually, we might have Anathapindika first. I'll have to look at how it all goes. Now, Anathapindika, the story that I will tell is the story of how Jetavana came about, how Anathapindika Saarame, the park of Anathapindika, how this came to be the park of Anathapindika. So there was this forest, a wana means forest, owned by Jeta, who was a royal prince or something. He was maybe just a rich guy. I think he was a prince, though. And it was quite close to Sawati. If you ever go to Sawati, or what's left of it, you'll see this huge... Well, you'll see this huge empty space, basically, surrounded by an ancient stone wall. And so you can see the city. If you stand up on one of the Jetia, that really the only thing left is these Jetia, which they say this one is Angulimala's Jetia, this one is Anathapindika's Jetia. A Jetia is like a funeral mound, like a pyramid in Egypt. And so you stand up on them and you can look and you can see the outline of the city. And then right near the city, there's a pond, and then past the pond, there's Jetavana. And so it was quite close to the city, and Anathapindika was this rich man who was also a person who gave great alms to the poor people. He was also a great follower of the Buddha. Anathapindika thought, I'll buy this for the Buddha, and then he'll be close to Sawati, so he won't have to be in the city, but he'll be close enough so that I can come and listen to his teachings and can come and give him gifts and so on. You know, give him food or whatever. Come and pay respect to him when I wish. So he asked Jeta to buy this park. And Jeta said, I'm not selling my park. That's, you know, it's his favorite forest. It's a wonderful, delightful forest. And Anathapindika kept pestering about it, to the point where he got so fed up that he said, fine, here's what I'll propose. If you cover the entire forest with gold, I'll sell it to you for that much. You know, thinking that it was just a ridiculous suggestion and there's no way, but Anathapindika, as soon as he heard this, he started carting out gold, you know, digging up his stores and going to his bank, and no, they didn't have banks in that time. Going to where he had hidden his gold, I guess, or his vaults or whatever, and just started pouring out this gold onto Jetavana, filling up the park with gold. And the story goes that he got it totally filled up, and Jeta was so amused by this, but he said to him, And he said, what about the trees? You haven't, you know, the space with the trees still isn't filled. And then Hatipindika, he was like, at this point, he was having the quart out all this gold. He didn't know what to say to that. And so Jeta said, well, I'll give you the space where the trees are for free. And so indeed, he sold. But Jeta was quite impressed by it, actually, the story goes. But not impressed enough to give it for free. So he, I guess he took all that gold. And Natapindika got this park, and he donated it to the Buddha. That's the legend. True or not, I don't know. But there's the story, and it's my duty to tell it. So now you know what Jetavana is. If you ever go to India, it's a nice place to visit. There's lots of old Jetia there. There's a well, there's the Buddha's kuti. You can see where the Buddha stayed. It's actually not a very big kuti. But really a nice place. Now it's occupied only by monkeys. Sad, really. They should let the monks back in and turn it into a real monastery again. Anyway, all beside the point. Now let's get to the story. What was happening? The Brahmin Janusoni was driving out of Savatthi in the middle of the day. Give me a second here. Now, this is, I guess, the moment where Janusoni became interested in the Buddha. So he was a well-to-do Brahmin. Now, Brahmins in India would have been the higher caste, and so he would have been well-to-do and sort of a well-known and well-respected person in society. And he meets this wanderer, Pilotika, coming, and he asks him, where have you been? And they enter into this exchange about that it's really quite impressive, and it's the kind of thing that would impress if it really happened, if this is really what was said, then it's something that I think would impress anybody. Because he doesn't just say the Buddha is great. So he asks him, what do you think of the Buddha? What do you think of his wisdom? And rather than saying, oh, he's very wise and so on, he says, how am I to know? He basically says, I'm in no position to estimate the Buddha's wisdom. Which is really quite appropriate because, well, from my point of view, if you read the Buddha's teaching, it really is quite difficult to estimate the Buddha's wisdom. It's easy to get caught up in the historics of it. Did the Buddha actually say this? Is this really the Buddha's teaching? But if you take the teachings that are in the texts that we have, it's, especially if you put them into practice, it's beyond impressive. It's something that is really quite difficult to imagine. How did someone come up with this? And if you look at the breadth of the things that the Buddha taught. And how clearly and concisely, and how he was able to cut through so much. One of the great things about what the Buddha taught is what he didn't teach, no? Because what you see the Buddha doing is cutting down everyone else's views and showing them that that's just a view and it's just an extrapolation. It's not really a part of reality. So he would take all these teachers of the time and show them how meaningless their views and their practices were. And some of the things that the Buddha taught seem quite simple and mundane. In fact, one of the things that we often say is that Buddhism really has no appeal to ordinary people because there's not enough there. it's too simple and it's really mundane. And I said before, the word mundane has such a negative connotation. Who wants something that's mundane? And so people often, if they're not on a level to appreciate it, they'll misunderstand. Mostly, if you don't have someone to explain it to you and to point out the importance of the mundane, the essential, the essential role the mundane plays in our spiritual development, then at the very least, it seems, well, mundane, no? to use the word. Because, of course, spiritual, the connotation is that it's super mundane, right? But this is the brilliance of the Buddha, and this is why people were flabbergasted, because he was a teacher. He wasn't just words on a page. And the Buddha was able to cut through people's delusions. So people come to him and ask him about magical powers and ask him about all sorts of things. And he would put everything in its place. And he would say to them, you know, in the end, it's just the six senses. I mentioned before, I don't know if I mentioned where it was, I think last week I mentioned talking about how I was teaching this Hindu woman, and everything, it came back to, yeah, that's seeing, or that's hearing. She said, oh, I would see this wonderful thing, and I said, yeah, well, that's seeing. And explaining that everything in the end is just, and it flabbergasted her. It was very, because she was so used to extrapolating and making more of things than they actually were. So this is the kind of impression that people get, because it's so clear. The Buddha's teaching is perfect clarity, being able to see reality for what it is, and to live with reality, to be with reality. So just some words on this sort of what's going on here. Why is he praising him? And the word he uses here is lucidity, and I haven't really looked that up. The word is panyaveyatiyang. And I don't know what that means. Panya means wisdom. But apologize, as I said, I haven't really gone through this, so we're going to have to just go with the translation. The translator says lucidity of wisdom. Doesn't make sense. But anyway, figuring about his, what do you think about his wisdom? He said, who am I to say? You know, the Buddha is visited by the king of the gods, and Brahma visits, God visits. The king of the angels visits the Buddha, God visits the Buddha. You know, he's praised by King Bimbisara, praises him. King Pasenadi praises him. And then he goes on to talk about, he has these four, I believe four similes. Yeah, right, the four footprints. And here we understand what he means by wisdom, what he means by when he talks about the Buddha's wisdom. Because people go to the Buddha, and if you read some of the discourses where the Buddha answers people's, where people ask the Buddha questions, it never turns out the way they expect. They'll come and they'll have some question in mind that's just totally, you know, meaningless. And the Buddha will just cut them down in a heartbeat. And so, as it says here, they don't even ask their question. They don't even get around to asking it, because all it takes is the Buddha to say, you know, oh, how are you? Are you bearing up? And the way of speaking, of course, the Buddha would understood the needs of the listener, and was able to, as you'll see, he's going to go through it here, and he would often give this talk. And what would happen is he would start talking in this way. And it would just make people totally forget about what they had come for, because suddenly he's telling the truth. Suddenly, and not only telling the truth, suddenly he's describing, he's pointing the way out. He's giving people what they really need. He's giving the cure to suffering. And he's showing the way, and he's matter-of-factly stating the entire path that he has taken, and that any person can take if they wish. So he said, there's these nobles. Noble here is Katya. We have to understand why he has four. The word noble, let's highlight this. Noble comes from Katya. Katya is the warrior class, as it's often called. So the reason there are four is because he's going to talk about the four castes, I believe. We'll go through it. So the first one is the Katriya. And he goes and he gives, they go to see the recluse Gotama, and he gives them a talk on the Dhamma. And he's seen this. I mean, this is really the proof is in the results. No, if you want to ask, and this is really, really important, if you want to ask what is the, or what good is someone's teaching, what good is this religion or that religion, what good is this philosophy or that philosophy, don't go by the doctrines, don't go by the culture, don't go by the traditions, don't go by the mode of dress or whatever. Go by the results that come from it. And this is what he saw. He saw that nobles, the Katya, who are like they would be the royal class, the rulers, kings would come to the Buddha. And they would have these naughty problems, and either the Buddha would solve them or they wouldn't even ask the problems, and they would become the Buddha's disciples. I mean, basically, what I'm saying is that nowadays, in modern times, you know it by the results of people who practice it. So we can tell the benefits of a meditation practice, for example, by the people who come out of it. It's really a good way, rather than becoming attached to our own meditation technique, we should talk to people. When someone comes to us and says, I practice this way, rather than immediately taking the stance, well, that's not our way and that therefore it's inferior, you should ask them what they got from it. And so, yeah, well, what are the results of that? And talk to them and engage in them. Because it may very well be that their practice for lack of a better word, better, but I don't suppose that's even the point. Their practice is valid. And you might very well learn something from them. But it's very important, because otherwise it leads to conceit, no, an attachment to our way. Attachment to views and so on. But this is the really how Buddhism has spread. No, it's never been. We always boast that Buddhism has never been a missionary religion, so we don't go out trying to convert people. And we don't have all sorts of doctrines to convince people. We don't have really any doctrines to convince people about the teaching. This is really the most powerful thing about Buddhism, is that without coercion, without any kind of threats or bribes or so on, Buddhism has spread simply by saying, come and see. It makes a bold claim, which I think is really unmatched in... Well, it's not often matched. in other religious or spiritual traditions, and that come and see, and you'll realize, you'll be able to judge for yourself. And that's really all it says. Come and practice for yourself. Because it's realizable, the results are verifiable. And not only by yourself, but you can ask yourself what happens to someone else when they become Buddhist. Some people actually don't like it. It's funny because family members often, when a family member goes to practice meditation and comes back, they'll often be quite upset, because my family was all upset because I no longer played the guitar and I was no longer into theater and music and so much fun I didn't want to have anymore, right? And there was no fun anymore. All my friends left me and so on. But I think in a sense that's part of the verifiability of it, that a person who practices in this way will verifiably be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, without any support. They can be thrust back into a society full of sensuality and still stay aloof from it, that they're able to pull themselves out of this consumerism, out of this consumption-based society. No, based system. Moreover, people who are wise and spiritual will be able to see the difference, and will see that, wow, this person who used to be into drugs and sex and rock and roll and whatever, immorality of all kinds, is now, clean of all that. And can't help but be impressed. So they will be attracted to other people. I mean, I think it's clear that a person who practices this meditation is able to do a lot for other people, is able to become a guide for other people, and at the very least become an example for many people. Not usually the people they're close to, who will often resent the change, because it's very hard to see your loved ones change in unexpected ways, but they'll often meet new people, and they'll meet people who are impressed by the benefits that they've gained and so on. So that's the kind of thing, the kind of context, is sort of what we're dealing with here. I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. Because then he goes on to talk about the Brahmins, and then it's not the four castes, it's the two high class groups, the Kattiyas and the Brahmins. So the Kattiya here would probably be referring specifically to, as he says, nobles or the royalty, the aristocracy. Brahmins are those priests. Probably the best translation is just a priest, someone who does religious, the person who is the intermediary between the householders and God or gods. Who does all these? You know, in India, the Brahmins did a lot of funny stuff. They, if you read about their actual details about their sacrifices, we studied this in university. It got to the point where it became so ritual that they didn't even know why they did the things they did. If you read these books, they had to bury a live turtle and a pound of butter under the altar, something like that. There's something about burying a live turtle under this altar that's shaped like an eagle. It's bizarre. It sounds like something out of Monty Python or something. Then you have to bring a goat and show the goat this pillar, this wooden pole that you've cut down from a special tree, and then lead the goat away. And the way we interpreted this, and it was interpreted, is that in olden times they had to kill the goat. But once Buddhism and Jainism came around, and people, they took the fun out of killing, they stopped doing that. And they said, well, let's just show because normally you'd tie the goat to the pillar and cut its head off, right? Well, they didn't want to do that anymore, so they just show the goat the pillar and then lead it away, and that was enough to appease the gods. Oh, that's right. It was supposed to be a live turtle, but they substituted it with a pound of butter. I think that's what it was. So, and then when you ask these people, because people were doing this apparently up until the 1970s, this is what we were studying, and I think they've stopped now, or it's just, maybe it's just, you know, very rare, hard to find anyway. And they went and asked these people, why are you doing it? And it really, there really was no answer. This is what we were informed. This is what we were told by our teachers studying in university. And they went and they studied these people and found that what they did. These were the rituals. They did them because that's the ritual they're supposed to do. There wasn't even a concept of getting a reward. There was some vague idea that it had a connection with heaven and a connection with getting some reward, but that wasn't why they were doing it. If a woman was on her period, she had to hold a white umbrella in her hand during the ceremony. There were things like this. So this is who the Brahmins were. Just some color to add to the discourse. And they would, you know, some of them would be clever and would be good at solving problems and good at arguing and debating. Because in India there was a huge tradition of debate. Indian people are prize intelligence. Even today you can see it. Intelligence is, and ability to debate, ability to argue. You feel it here in Sri Lanka. It's something quite different from East Asia. In Sri Lanka, people are very, very much into argument and debate. That's quite refreshing, actually. And so, this is another thing I've mentioned before that you see in the Buddha's teaching, that the Buddha was good at debate, and the monks were good at debate, and very much familiar with debate. There are actually texts that are that you can find that show the various schools debating and having formal debate. One class I took, I think, was Indian debate or something. Debate in Indian, I don't remember what it was. But we did study quite in detail this idea of debate or this phenomenon. And so this is not an unusual thing to talk about. What he's saying here, he's talking about the debaters in their society. But anyone who went to debate the Buddha, and there's suttas that we can go through, there's suttas where you see this. Maybe we can put one on our list. Where people would... There's the famous one, I can't remember the name, in the Digha Nikaya, of this guy who boasted like this. It's the example of what he's talking about. Let's see if I can find it. Is it the Pattika Sutta? What's it called? Does anyone know the sutta I'm talking about in the Digha Nikaya? The Potapada Sutta, I believe, is the one. Yeah. Is it? Uh-oh. No, it's not the Potapada Sutta. I gotta find this now. The Kevata Sutta. No. Someone have an idea what the sutta is I'm talking about? Give me a second here. We're in no hurry, no? That was the Potapada Sutta. No, then it's in the next one. Not Vyasi. Maybe it is the Patthika Sutta. Patthika Sutta. No. Probably not going to get it here. Pasadika. Ah well, I forget it. I'll find it out later. Anyway, there's one where this Brahmin makes a boast, and he says that he's going to have a debate with the Buddha. And he said, when I have a debate with the Buddha, I'm going to throw the Buddha around and beat him up, and you know, with my tongue, you know, with my words. And then exactly this happens. He doesn't even get a chance to ask his question. Anyway, so the point you find this in the discourses. There's many examples of how this happened. The Buddha, you see the times when the Buddha debated anyone, and he really just destroyed them, which is really, you know, it's not hard to understand, because the Buddha had the perfect one-to-one correspondence, his views and reality. The things that the Buddha believed, the things that the Buddha taught, were what is real. It's a bold statement, really, but it's undeniable. So people who deny the Buddha's teaching or try to refute the Buddha's teaching are really just playing with snake oil, or you know, creating, being tricky in some way, trying to create some confusion, because there's nothing in the core of the Buddha's teaching that is deniable. Nothing. So people will say, "Oh, the Buddha's teaching is pessimistic," right? When you say something like that, you're covering over this whole deep and profound teaching that we learned in the first sutta on the Four Noble Truths. Because it's just because it's talking about something negative, right? It's talking about suffering. And you say, oh, it's talking about suffering. Well, then it's pessimistic. So you use this word to cover over the fact that what the Buddha is really talking about is how to become free from suffering. How to find happiness, how to find peace. This trickery that people use. It's the only thing you can do, because otherwise you have to accept what the Buddha said. It really is the way things are. You know, examples like some of the arguments that I've had, or not the arguments, but things that people have found hard to swallow about karma. For example, karma in a Holocaust. When you say, well, you know, people who die in a Holocaust were really just going according to their karma, or if you maybe not put it so hard or so definitely, but you say karma had a place to had a role to play, even in a Holocaust or in any, you know, genocide of any sort, as an example. Or my talk on physical exercise, saying that physical exercise serves no purpose, saying that sex has no purpose, procreation has no purpose, the human race has no purpose. It's something that people argue vehemently. These are things that people argue vehemently against. But what you have to see is that they're doing so based on illogical premises, or relative and conventional or subjective premises. Like when you say, well, sex is for procreation, yeah, MN 35, but there's one in the Digha that I can't find. Anyway, If you say sex is for procreation, well, then you have to say, well, what's procreation for? Well, for the continuation of the human race. Well, what's the continuation of the human race for? It's the same argument that you have for God. If you say, well, God created the universe, well, then who created God? Or we have purpose, God gave us a purpose. Well, then what's the purpose of God, right? And so on. I mean, just examples like this. Once you become universal, once you take on a all-encompassing outlook, and you really try to make sense of reality, really trying to make sense of reality in a universal sense, not just a even earthbound sense, or more usually a cultural, social framework. Once you try to make it universal and really try to grapple with what it means to exist, then you come to the conclusion the Buddha did. And this is why people found it so profound, because it goes to the core. The Buddha's teaching is equally applicable to an angel in heaven or a Brahma, God, as it is to a human being. It's equally applicable to a king as it is to a beggar. It holds throughout all of reality. So this is why it's quite difficult to debate and argue against. And it makes our job a lot easier, right? In order to defend Buddhism, you just have to really defend reality. You have to. The hardest part is talking to people who don't see reality, who can't see reality, because for the most part we live in concepts, no? So, and we're very subjective, and we have we're very much influenced by our surroundings and by our position and so on. And so we're unable to see things objectively. We're unable to look at reality for what it is. This is, hence the importance of meditation. You can't argue someone to enlightenment. But part of how the Buddha would debate people, and part of what made the Buddha such a good debater, is because he wouldn't engage them in debate. He'd say, put that aside for now. Suppose you sit down and meditate and look at reality and start to, calm your mind, tranquilize your mind, and then look and see what's really going on. I mean, right now, and this is why I always encourage us when we're studying this, let's not forget to come back and look at ourselves. What are we doing right now? What's going on in your mind? What's going on in your body? How's your brain doing? Headaches? Are you enjoying this, or are you doubtful about what I say? What's going on in your mind? Because that's really what we're talking about. I'm not trying to give you some views, and the Buddha wasn't trying to give people views. He's trying to help you to see what views you have and learn about how your mind works. So quite likely, as you've been listening here, many emotions have been going through your mind. Sometimes you agree, maybe sometimes you're not sure. Sometimes maybe you really don't agree. The point is none of the above. The point is to look at these very mind states. See what's going on in your mind. This is what we should be doing. This is how we should be studying. We haven't even gotten to the Buddha yet, but even without getting to the Buddha, we can already start to practice. Just hearing the Buddha's name and have people talk about the Buddha, we can already begin to approach the Dhamma. So we have Brahmins, and then the third word this man uses is Gahapati. Gahapati means a householder. So this would have been a merchant. It would have been probably of the third class, the merchant class. And he doesn't mention the fourth class, which is the outcasts or the beggars or the slaves or whatever, the suddhas. The fourth one is the recluse. And these are the four, I believe these are the four groups or something. The four types of group is the groups of Brahmins, the groups of Khatiyas, and the groups of householders, and the groups of recluses. And then even recluses, and he is one of these recluses. They go to see the Buddha and can't even ask him their question. It's not that the Buddha doesn't give them the opportunity, it's that their question seems stupid. It's beside the point. There's an interesting set of questions that were asked the Buddha. If you're interested in the kind of questions people would ask, you can look in the Sutta Nipata, which is something that we should look at. I don't know if it's too terse for us to approach, but it's a wonderful set. The 16 questions of the disciples of Bhavari is his name? This Brahmin and his 16 disciples. I think he sends his 16 disciples to ask questions to the Buddha. And they all become enlightened except for one who goes back and relates the answer to his teacher. And then becomes enlightened, something like that. And so it's not to say actually that the Buddha doesn't answer questions, because he does answer many questions. I think the issue here is that these Brahmins were trying to catch the Buddha, and that never works. But lots of people came to the Buddha and asked questions. When they were really interested in learning, the Buddha answered, and the Buddha would give them a good answer and something that would often bring them enlightenment. Sometimes it would just bring them faith. A really good example, here's one that I can point to. Let's hope I can find this one. I think I was just looking at it. The Pasadika Sutta, I believe, is it. No, that's not it. I should really know my suttas better than this. If I were more prepared. The sutta of this householder, Udai? Anyway, there's a householder, maybe someone can tell me the sutta. There's a householder who's a student of Nigantha Nataputta, the Jayan leader. And Nigantha Nataputta says you should go and talk to the Buddha, debate with the Buddha, because it's either you should debate with the Buddha or I should debate with the Buddha. You're the only one qualified like me to debate with the Buddha. And this other guy says, no, don't send him, because the Buddha has this magic. He has this converting magic. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. And if he uses that converting magic on this man, then he will become the Buddha's disciple. And Nigantha Nataputta said, oh, that's ridiculous. And then it does happen, and Nigantha Nataputta says, oh, you've been converted by this magic. He's used his magic on you. And this man says, oh, if only all of my friends and relatives could be converted by this magic. If only the Buddha would work this magic on all of my friends and relatives. It's a great sutta because it shows... Please, someone can find this for me. It's not the Sela Sutta. Really good one. We need more people who know the suttas. Because obviously I don't. Agahapati, here we are. Let's see if I can find it. Upali Sutta? No, it's not the Upali, is it? I know where I can find it. Yeah, the Chula Satchika Sutta is a really good one. It's a good example. Majjhima Nikaya 35. But he actually... he actually gets his point across. He's actually able to ask his question. But you can see in the sutta how he's brought to his knees. It is the Upali Sutta, isn't it? No. That's it. Yeah, it is the Upali Sutta. And so Upali goes to... this guy hears from the Buddha that the Buddha says the mind is most important, right? And he says to him, mind is the most important. You have body, you have speech and mind. Which one is most potent? Which one is most reprehensible? If you do an evil with mind, or if you do an evil with speech, or if you do an evil with body, which one is the worst? And the Buddha said, well, mind is the worst. Mental action is the most reprehensible. When you do an evil deed with mind, that's the worst out of the three. And not so much bodily action or verbal action. And they get him to repeat this three times so that he can't wiggle out of it. So it's like on the record. You're on the record for saying, because they think this is ludicrous. The Jayans believe that it was the body, right? It was physical. So you have to sweep in front of you, and you have no excuse. If you don't look through your food, and it turns out that there's a bug in your food, and you kill this bug by eating, you're guilty of murder, even though you didn't know that the bug was there. So they always have to look through their food to make sure there is no living being in it, for example. They always have to sweep in front of them. Because if they step on an ant, even without knowing that it's there, they're guilty of murder. So they're like, oh, good, now we've got something that we can argue with them, and go and refute his doctrine. And Diga Tapasi says, no, don't do that. Don't send him, because Recluse Gotama is a magician and knows a converting magic by which he converts disciples of other sectarians. And Nigantha Natapunta says, oh, Tapasi, it's impossible. Upali should never become a disciple of the Buddha. But it could happen that Gotama would become a disciple of Upali. That's absurd, isn't it? Maybe you can go see the Buddha and maybe he'll come to say, oh, you're right. I was wrong all this time. Anyway, it seems kind of absurd, but this is the arrogance. No. Yeah, people have their beliefs. And the Tapasi kept saying, please, please don't send him. He said, yeah, he could never have any trouble. So he sends Upali. And Upali, basically, as soon as he sees the Buddha and hears the Buddha speak some words, even before he's even asking questions, he's converted. It's like the movie, You Had Me at Hello. The Buddha really had him at hello. He gets him with these simple statements, and then he starts to explain his argument. Why do you say that the mental rod? And Upali said, the bodily rod is the most reprehensible. It's not. How could it possibly be the mental rod? And then the Buddha starts to explain to him all of these ways, and it's a little bit technical, you have to understand. But he explains all these ways in which the mental rod is, of course, more important, because if you kill an ant not knowing that you've stepped on it, how could you possibly be affected by it? How could it possibly be considered bad karma? It goes back to the idea of thinking that bad deeds are determined by an external source, like God, for example. And on the other hand, even if you simply think something bad, if you want to kill someone, but you don't do it, then it's quite clear that it does have a very strong impact on your mind. A person can plot murder and never actually commit it and still suffer greatly for it and become totally corrupted in mind without ever having done anything at all. If you stop and think about it, it's actually quite a simple argument, but it makes for a good sutta, and eventually Upali becomes converted, and then Nigantha Nataputta goes to see him and thinks, oh, now he's converted the Buddha, how did it go? And Upali treats him like dirt and says, you can go and sit on that low seat, because he has no use for this guy anymore. He sees this guy was a fraud, and anyway, it's kind of well, I don't know. It's a good example of how these things worked out. Good example of a debate. There's many examples of a debate, and you'll find that a great many of the suttas are just that, a debate. And some people have argued, well, of course the Buddha wins all the debates. If the Buddha lost a debate, they wouldn't put it in the Tipitaka, now would they? One of my professors argued that, and fair enough. I mean, I'm not trying to. It's not that we're trying to claim or boast or brag, and so look at how great we are. So this is really only internal. As Buddhists and people interested in Buddhism, we get a glimpse of how we understand history to have gone. That the Buddha was an incredible debater and so on, and it's not something to be proud of. It's just the way it seems to have gone. It is kind of a reassurance, and it's something that you can read through, and you can see that, wow, anyone who could debate in this way has a very clear mind, and it's clear that the Buddha knew what he was talking about and taught something that really is based on the truth and based on reality. This argument is a good example of the difference between the physical and the mental, because it was a big issue in India. And people who haven't meditated, spiritual leaders who haven't meditated, this is why they fall into the view of God and morality based on an external source, or morality based on the physical action or so on, because they have no understanding of how experience really works. Even just a little bit of meditation will show you, really, without the mind, there's no such thing as morality or good or bad deeds. It's only when you just begin to talk about it. It's only when you include the mind and you're talking about in terms of the experience of the mind that you can begin to talk about good and bad deeds and their result. So here we get to the end of the introduction, where the Buddha, or where we're talking about this man's idea of his reasoning as to why he thinks the Buddha is fully enlightened. So here he says, if you're down at the same paragraph as I am, here I've highlighted it, these are the four footprints of the recluse Gotama. So he's thinking of the Buddha as an elephant. Hatti means elephant. So this is the Chula Hatti Padopama Sutta. Opama, upama. Upama means comparison or a simile. Hatti pada, pada means foot, pada, and hatti means elephant. So the simile of the elephant's footprints. He sees these four elephant footprints, and he knows, wow, this is a full-sized elephant. This is a big elephant. In the same way, he said, based on this, based on the fact that the Buddha is a good debater, based on the Buddha is able to just trounce anyone in debate and has been able to convert just about everyone he came across, it brings me to the conclusion that he is fully enlightened. Now the interesting thing is that the Buddha, when he hears this, he denies it. He says that's not a reason to think someone is enlightened. So even all of the wondrous power that the Buddha has displayed, even if it had been in regards to the miracles that the Buddha displayed, or the number of converts that he had, Buddha said none of this is a sufficient premise to come to the conclusion that someone is enlightened. And we're going to go through it now. Well, first we'll go through the Buddha's similes. But the point in this is that the Buddha is offering something in this instance that is unheard of. And this is the idea that someone can actually be sure of something. You have to stop and think about that for a second, because science can't be sure of anything. It's one of the boasts of science that it doesn't try to make truth statements. It doesn't try to say we have proof of this and proof of that. You'll never hear a scientist talk about proof. Right? They talk about evidence, and they'll always say, and this is kind of a boast, is how scientific it is. Instead of trying to prove something, you accept something when it's the most reasonable solution based on observations, with the knowledge that a single counter-observation is all it would take to shatter your theory. And going by this, you are always safe. And it's true, it's a good boast, and the Buddha has said this before. He said, as long as you stick with the truth, as long as you go by what you've actually experienced and the actual conclusions that come from it, you know, basically, as I said, this is, the evidence suggests X. Well, if the evidence does suggest X, then you're telling the truth. But you haven't arrived at the truth yet. So the Buddha is offering something that is, well, I guess highly controversial, and that's the idea that you can actually know something. You can be sure of something. And this doesn't mean sure in the sense that there's enough evidence to make it reasonable. Sure means nothing could shake your knowledge. Nothing could shake your conviction. Nothing. It's an impossibility. Literal impossibility. It cannot happen that your knowledge could be shaken. That's what the Buddha is saying, and this is what we're going to see as we go through this sutta. And it's a very powerful statement to make. Example: recently, someone posted an article that said, the title of the article was "Child's Memories and Nightmares," was it? And some of you have seen this article, I think. Prove reincarnation. And I think it's talking about this kid who believes he was a World War II pilot. And yeah, many people have already seen these videos. And it's a cool video, and you know, power to it. I'm right there. I think, yeah, probably this kid was a World War II fighter pilot. I mean, hey, maybe he wasn't, and there's lots of arguments as to how it might be otherwise explained, but I give him the benefit of the doubt. I don't have a problem with that. But I would never say proves. And this is, someone posted a comment right away and said, how can you use the word proof? Proof is, you know, it's hardly proof. It's evidence, but it's not proof. And you know, I agreed with that. I said, yes, proof is not a word that a scientist uses. But then I thought to myself, well, you know, unless unless you're a Buddhist scientist. But the funny thing is the proof that you get is personal. You can't explain to anyone what you've experienced. Or you can't prove to anyone what you've experienced. I was talking to this atheist leader. I was discussing. It started out as a discussion, and I told him how when I was young, I had this experience where I saw the future. I actually experienced something that hadn't happened yet, and then I actually saw it happen in real life. And he said, "I don't believe you." And he was making a statement by that, saying, you know, what you're saying is anecdotal. What you're saying is not proof because you can't prove it to me. And he's right, I can't prove it to him. It doesn't mean what I'm saying is not true. And I've proven it to myself. The distinction, this is getting a little bit off topic, but it's an important distinction in Buddhism. It's an important distinction to talk about. You can be sure that you had an experience. See, because people say, well, then someone who, it's the same as when someone, and this is what they argued, I think, it's the same as if someone comes to me and said they saw God. And the truth is, no, it's not. When a person says they saw God, I'll believe them up until the point where they say they saw something. But when they say what they saw was God, they've broken with the truth, or they've broken with what is sure, what is certain. Because, okay, it may be God, but it may not be God. It may just be something you ate, or it could be anything. It most likely is not God. So when you say you have an experience of something, that's quite different from saying this experience means X, Y, or Z. It means something other than what it was. And so the point here is that there are people, and there certainly have been people in the past, who have experienced complete freedom from suffering. Have realized the things that the Buddha said were realizable. They have come to experience these things. So they can say for themselves, what the Buddha says is realizable. What the Buddha says is realizable is realizable. They can also verify the nature of that experience. They can say, it is peace. Nibbana is peace, for example. They can verify that craving leads to suffering. They can verify really all of the Buddha's teachings. You can verify things like rebirth. You can verify that it's possible to read people's minds if you want to go there. You can verify that it's possible to fly through the air. And even apparently, I mean, according to my experience, you can tell the future. There's stories of the Buddha doing it in much more profound ways, and of people, other people doing it. There's a lot of interesting stuff that can go on. And you can verify these things. This is verifiable. So once you verify that, then you come to the conclusion that the Buddha is enlightened. And that's at the end of the sutta, so I'm jumping way ahead, but this is the context of what the Buddha is about to say. So then he's gonna give his own simile of the elephant. And he said, he basically, someone goes in and looking for an elephant, and then they just see the footprints. And he says, well, you know, some people would look at the footprints and say, oh, that person's in that, or that elephant's a huge elephant. That's a big bull elephant, right? And this is what people do in religion as well, right? The smallest thing, and people think you're enlightened. There's one good example, and it's, I guess, a bit controversial, but a monk is said to be enlightened if when they die, this is not in the text, but in a certain group of, in a certain culture that we're going to leave unnamed, certain subgroup in a certain society that many of you are already familiar with, a monk is considered enlightened when after he dies his bones turn to crystal. It's actually not a single society, because I've heard this story in several places, and this is a widespread belief. As a perfect example of how someone should not come to the conclusion that someone is enlightened. So one nun, she told me this of this wonderful monk, who, and I'm not saying he's not wonderful, he could be wonderful, but she said he's enlightened, and we know he's enlightened because his skin smells like fruit. It apparently really does. Who knows, he could be putting perfume on when no one's looking. He could have some kind of special perfume. But people go visit him, and he lives on top of a mountain, and meat is not allowed on the mountain, right? It's forbidden. And somehow it's something like magically it will never be possible to bring meat up on the mountain. And when men come to see him, he lets them smell his hand. And when women, they come and they smell his feet. Right? Because women, of course, are only worthy to smell his feet, I guess. And it smells like fruit. And they said, everyone thinks he's an arahant. He's enlightened. Another good example of how one should not estimate a person to be enlightened. But this is what new. In all religions, they do this. There's a book, The Brothers Karamazov. It's not a book. It's one of the classics of literature. Is it Dostoevsky? And this priest, he's well, and everybody thinks he's a saint, you know? And he's got magical powers because he's broken with, he's a monk, sorry, he's not a priest, he's a monk. This is why I was interested in this story. And everyone thinks he's a saint because he has all these wise advice for people. Most monks at the time would not give wise advice. They would go off and meditate, and not exactly meditate, mostly they would torture themselves. There was another monk in the same monastery who was torturing himself. But no one was paying much attention to him because they liked this monk who gave good teachings. And he really did give good teachings and good advice, but people thought he had magic powers and was enlightened and so on. Was a saint. And then he died. And of course, when a saint dies, you expect miracles, right? So everyone was standing around expecting miracles and just thinking somehow he's going to give us a sign. And they waited and they waited and they waited all day and I think into the afternoon. And Dostoevsky describes it so well. He says, and then his body started to smell. And he says, it's such a natural thing. Of course his body would start to smell. But it just spread like wildfire, and people were horrified. How could a saint's body do such a thing? And they suddenly, the whole idea of him being a saint was just crushed because his body started, his decomposing body started to smell. I think it's another good example of how one should not judge people. So many of these exist. You know? People, there's examples of very, very well-known religious leaders who turn out to be, you know, this man who turned out to be hiring prostitutes. It was a very strong anti-homosexual advocate, you know, anti-homosexuality. Many people know who he is. And then it turns out he was hiring homosexual prostitutes. So this is very incredibly pertinent in teaching that we have here in front of us. That we should be very careful in judging whether someone is enlightened. Another thing I'd say about this is, we shouldn't be too judgmental. and I've said this before, that yeah, very important not to get too caught up thinking someone is enlightened, but we shouldn't be too caught up on whether a person is enlightened or not. Much more important is their teachings. Because it's very hard for us to assess whether the Buddha is enlightened. I mean, that's basically what this sutta is getting at, that what basis would you use to figure out whether the Buddha was enlightened? If you read the Tipitaka, there's nothing in there that you can put two and two together and get four. Oh yes, it's clear he's enlightened. You can't do that. But you can put the teachings into practice, see what they bring. And this is where someone, as I said, becomes clear that the Buddha was enlightened, because his teachings are that which leads to enlightenment. So either he learned it from someone else who was enlightened, or he was enlightened himself. There's only two ways, because his teaching leads to enlightenment. How do I know I'm enlightened? This is an example. I'm not saying I'm enlightened, but this is what a person would say. When they become enlightened, they would say, I know the Buddha's enlightened because, well, I've practiced his teachings and here I am, poof, enlightened. That's the end of this sutta, what it's going to come to. Okay. So, first one. Second one, he sees some scrapings high up. So he sees on these trees that some tusks, some tusk markings. And then he says, but, you know, it's possible that there are big she elephants that have teeth. And they could be biting, I guess. I didn't know elephants had big teeth. Ah, sorry, scrapings are referring to the teeth. So here we have marks made by tusks. Well, when marks are made by tusks, then you think, ooh, apparently she elephants can have tusks as well. So, the point being that with any of these signs, and this is all going to have to do with conjecture and that which is unessential, taking it to be proof that the Buddha has reached the essence. Because you can never reach the essential by means of the unessential. And so we're going to go through many things here that are actually unessential and therefore are not proof that the Buddha reached the essential or reached enlightenment. Aha. So then we have the fourth simile. And what is this? We have the elephants. We have the footprints. Big footprints, we have high up scrapings that couldn't have been made by small elephants, we have marks made by tusks and broken off branches. But most importantly, we have the bull elephant. And so this guy, he's actually come to the point where he sees the bull elephant at the root of the tree. And at that point, you can ask yourself, is it possible for him to delude himself into believing that this isn't a bull elephant, that he's dealing with something else here? It's impossible, because now he's seen the bull elephant. It's a quite simple argument. But then he comes to the conclusion, this is a big bull elephant. He can't come to any other conclusion, because, well, that's what it is. It's quite clearly a male bull elephant. Okay, so this is the simile. Now, what does it mean? And here we get the standard. This is a standard phrase, and it's one that we actually chant in Thailand. We would chant this. Ida tathagato loke ubhacati arahang sama sambuddho vijja charana sampanno sugato lokavidu. And so on. So imang lokang sadevakang samarakang sambrahmakang. Every day we would chant this in Thailand. And they still chant it now every day. So it's a stock phrase that you hear. It's a powerful one, I think. Here a Tathagata, Tathagata is a word for the Buddha, appears in the world. And this goes through the standard list of epithets of the Buddha. Arahang, Samma, Sambuddho, Vijja, Charana Sampanno. Endowed with knowledge and conduct. Sugato, gone to goodness. Lokavidu, knower of the worlds. Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati. Sarati means a charioteer, one who leads. But Sarati, Ratta means a chariot or a cart. Sarati means one who has carts. So the imagery here is of Dhamma. Dhamma refers to training. So the imagery is of a charioteer taming their horses, training their horses to behave. So the meaning is he's a trainer, he's able to train people, which is very powerful actually. The idea of training someone, a trainer, is a very important sort of person. People who train others physically really do them a great service. And this is someone who trains people mentally. There are people in the world who do this actually, who train people to be more confident and so on. And they're very well respected and can often make a good living. But the Buddha was the incomparable one. Satta Deva Manusanang, the teacher of gods and men, or angels and humans. Buddho Bhagava. Buddho, he was one who knows. Bhagava, blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas. Now, what does it mean to say he declares this world? So imang lokang sadevakang pavedeti. He makes clear this world. That's really what the Buddha did. He explains the world. He explains existence, the loka. He explains reality. He explains it, knowing it clearly for himself with higher knowledge. So dhammang deseti, he teaches the dhamma. Adi kalyanam, beautiful in the beginning. Madhye kalyanam, beautiful in the middle. Pariyosana kalyanam. This is an important passage. Adi kalyanam, the beginning. It's beautiful in the beginning. That refers to morality. So it's beautiful in regards to its practice of morality. Madhye kalyanam, beautiful in the middle. This is regards to concentration, because when your mind is moral, when you've established the mind in a meditation object, the morality that comes from that, the mental behavior that is straight and honest and sincere, leads to concentration. Pariyosana kalyanam, this is talking about wisdom, which is the final, because when your mind is focused on reality, focused properly, then you see things as they are. And seeing things as they are, that's the beauty of the end. But this is, when you hear about the Buddha talking about the beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end, he's referring to the three trainings. Satang sabbyanjanang, beautiful in both the letter and the meaning. This means it's beautifully expounded. The teaching itself is well laid out, and the meaning is correct. So someone can have a well laid out teaching, which is sabbyanjanang, which is according to the byanjana, the letters, the wording of it is beautiful, but it may be a trick, it may not be correct. Right? Like a person can be very eloquent in explaining why we should worship God, or so on. And this is really the trick, is that eloquence alone doesn't mean that the things being spoken are correct. This is the mistake so many people make. But when a person is a good speaker, everyone thinks, oh, he's enlightened and he's telling the truth and we have to listen to him and he must know what he's talking about. And this is what the Buddha is cautioning against. You have to go by the results. You have to go by what his teachings lead to. It doesn't mean you should deny it or be skeptical about it, but you should put it to the test and see what it leads to. That's what it means, satang. Satang means the meaning of it, or the meaning, yes, the meaning of the Buddha's teachings is beautiful, because it actually leads to what it says. It actually leads to a good thing, leads to the best thing, leads to freedom. Kevala paripunang, totally, completely complete. No? What's the... utterly perfect. Kevala paripunang. But the word here isn't perfect, actually. Kevala paripunang. Kevala means completely, I believe. And paripunang, puna means full. Pari means totally full. Or completely full. So totally and completely full. I guess perfect is a good... But the meaning of perfect here is not its accuracy. It means complete. Totally complete. It means he hasn't left anything out. Parisuddha means pure. Means it has no fault. This is more perfect. Parisuddha means pure. Brahmacharyang is the life he teaches, the holy life. Pakaseti, he makes known or makes clear. Okay, then what happens? Well, some gahapati or a gahapati putta, a son of a householder, leaves, or as someone from some family, goes forth. Pachajato, from some family, he, having listened to the Dhamma of the Buddha, gives rise to faith. And I'm going to stop translating. Let's just read it. He acquires faith in the Tathagata. Possessing the faith, he considers, and this is a wonderful one. Yeah, listen up, Matt. Sambado garavaso rajapato. Sambado garavaso rajopato. Household life is crowded and dusty. Abokaso babaja. Abokaso babaja. Going forth is the open air. Abokaso. Nayidang sukarang agarang ajavasata ekanta paripunang ekanta parisudang kangkalikitang brahmacharyang charitum. It's not easy to live the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell, while living at home. So not having given, living in the home life, it's not easy to live a perfectly pure, or practice the Dhamma perfectly pure, because there's so much that gets in your way. When you live at home, you have family, you have friends, you have good food, you have lots of entertainment, so many distractions. Even when you want to meditate, there are things that distract you. There are things that get in your way. I had a Sri Lankan man who lives in Canada, and he asked me when I was in Canada, he said he wants to go to Thailand to practice, and I said, come to Sri Lanka. And he actually took me up on it. He actually did end up coming to Sri Lanka. I think he's still in Sri Lanka now. But when he got to Sri Lanka, before he even got to me, Before, you know, he didn't even make it to the monastery. He was hoodwinked by his family and friends and this woman, and suddenly he was involved in a relationship with a woman. Finally, he did make it to the monastery, but within a few days he left again because he had to sort out things with his mother in regards to this woman. And then he did come back. As I pushed him quite strongly, I said, you know, come back. And he actually finished the course. He finished an entire meditation course with me here quite well, and did quite well, actually. But he said to me, he said, this is why I wanted to go to Thailand, because I don't know anyone in Thailand. And I've heard this from other Sri Lankan people. As soon as they set foot in the country, they're kidnapped, and their time is not their own. I think Vinita was someone who talked to that, about that with me. And I think you can appreciate that wherever you are, that you get caught up in so many different things. This is a famous thing that the Buddha would say, or that other people would say. They would come to this realization, and this is why they would leave the home life. They say, you can't easily practice in the home. What if I were to cut off my hair and beard and put on the yellow robe and go forth from homeless life into homelessness? And on a later occasion, abandoning a large or small fortune, he shaves off his head and beard, puts on a yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. So he does it. Or not. Some people, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy. There's more to it than is said here, because many people have wanted to become ordained but still have unfinished business. And that's part of what is being said here. This is the implication here, where it says, on a later occasion, abandoning a small or large fortune, abandoning a small or large circle of relatives. The point is clearing up his business, getting to the point where he can actually do away with this, clearing up his debts, giving away his fortune and giving up his family, and getting to the point where he's able to give up these attachments and actually does it. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. I should have stopped actually before this, but I didn't. So we went on, because now we're into the second half of the sutta, and we'll save that for next week, where we actually get into the course of practice. But I think that was a good, you know, some good opportunities to elaborate on the Buddha's teaching. So I think that was a good session. I'd like to thank everyone for coming. If you have questions now, you're welcome to ask. Of course, you're always welcome to ask questions. And otherwise, we'll finish there. And tomorrow we have our radio show, and you'll get to meet our two meditators, and maybe you can ask them questions. Where are we? Okay. We are here. So otherwise, we'll see you again next week, November 26th. And before we go, we will scroll back up to the top and do our homage again, for those of you who like such things. So let's do that now, and then if people have questions, they can stick around, and we can talk a little more if there's questions. Okay, so. Arahang samma sambuddho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivadin. Svakato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namasam. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namam. Okay. Thanks for coming, everyone. That ends our study session for today.